The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This period of time in 2013-2014, when things really escalated, part of this a response to Russia's perception of the Maidan, these pro-Western, anti-Russian democracy protests, you can call them, in Ukraine. They perceive those as kind of, as they often do, as a CIA plot, you know, this kind of thing. And it led to I have a segment in the book where you see the very quick succession of steps in response to that. Crimea, you know, Eastern Ukraine. Sadly, soon after that, the MH17 shoot down. Also at the same time, Russia begins a massive cyber attack on the U.S. State Department email system, a successful one. And they were in there for a long time before they were discovered. I speak to Rick Legette, the former deputy director of the NSA, and he says, looking back, we should have seen the State Department email hack as a sign of what was to come in 2016, because they used similar guy, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. They were active a couple years before. So the reason I do that is to see that there was a buildup. This did not come out of nowhere. You know, that Pearl Harbor, as it were, was preceded by a lot of very aggressive activity.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for June 15th, 2019. Russian and Chinese leaders understand that they are unlikely to win a shooting war with the United States. But they have other ways to challenge Western interests, turning our greatest strengths, open societies, dominance of technology on Earth and in space, and military innovation into weaknesses. CNN anchor and chief national security correspondent Jim Sciutto calls it the Shadow War, and it's the subject of his new book of the same name. I recently sat down with Jim to talk about these asymmetric threats to national security and what the United States and its allies can do to fight back. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 426, Jim Sciutto on the Shadow War. Let's start out. Give us a quick definition of what you call the shadow war. How is it similar to and different from the concept of hybrid warfare?
Well, the shadow war encompasses hybrid warfare tactics, but it expands it to multiple fronts. It is things like interfering in an election. It is things like little green men in Ukraine. In other words, plausible deniability for territorial aggression. But it's other things that I think folks just aren't that aware of, deploying weapons in space, because the U.S. military and civilian institutions, things you and I depend on every day, are dependent on space assets that Russia and China calculate. If they take them away from us, they can paralyze us. And they're right. Mm-hmm. And they can. The weapons are already floating around up there in the sky. It's about military expansion in areas where Russia and China believe they can compete with us. They're not going to suddenly build 12 aircraft carriers. But both of them have made enormous advances in submarine technology to the point where U.S. sub commanders can't track them as well as they used to. Mm-hmm. And a sub is a great weapon to pop up off your coastline without warning, or pop up in the midst of an aircraft carrier group without warning and strike. It's by its nature an offensive weapon, and they've made enormous strides there.
So you incorporate in this the idea of asymmetric warfare. They're not trying to match us carrier for carrier, although in some ways I think you make the point that they're actually matching us in some areas that we may not have anticipated 20, 30 years ago.
They are certainly in the cybersphere, no mm-hmm. question. They're ahead of us on the space front, which is talked about in the present tense among U.S. military planners. Of course, the president mm-hmm. talks about a space force. That's a bit of rebranding. We already have a space command. And when you, as I have done, go to the many bases or some of the many bases around the world, they already speak of themselves as space warriors. They speak mm-hmm. in those terms. So it is hybrid warfare on multiple fronts, but crucially, and this is a part of it that's essential to both Russia and China, to their strategies, and that is striking just below what they perceive as the threshold for a kinetic response, a military response, or really just a decisive response, and stretching that threshold over time. And both China and Russia have been pretty good at calculating where that threshold is. Listen, Russia's invaded a European country. Mm-hmm. We've slapped some sanctions on them, but they're still there.
Now, have they been good at calculating that, or have they, in a sense, gotten lucky by not realizing where our boundaries are, and our boundary just keeps moving?
Well, it's interesting. It does keep moving. They're good at reading that. And listen, I don't want to invest either Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping with superhuman powers beyond what they have. And you could make an argument that both Putin and Xi have overplayed their hands in several ways, in a number of ways. But when you look at the march of aggression over years and decades, they have gained things and undermined the U.S. advantage across the board in ways that can only be seen as successes for what they want. And beyond things like Russia wants to regain old parts of its near abroad, Ukraine, take back the warm water port in Sevastopol, disrupt a country they saw as going too far into the West. China wanted to establish itself in the midst of the South China Sea, territories claimed by many nations, including U.S. allies. They've succeeded in that. But also, just bigger picture, disrupt, weaken, put us on our back foot, as the British would say, here and there. And they've done a great job of that as well. Just look at the election interference. Beyond advantaging Donald Trump, they've helped exacerbate divisions in the country. Sure. All that kind of stuff serves their interest.
All right. So let's go back a step. You note that it's difficult to identify a single starting point to this shadow war. But there's a good candidate for the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko with polonium-210. Why did it take the United Kingdom a decade to point the finger at Russia and blame them for that episode?
And the U.S., really, because the U.S. didn't sanction one of the assassins in 2017. It took us a decade, too, to get around to it. I start the book off there because it struck me. The outrage at the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury, England last year, similar to Litvinenko. So they use a very powerful substance.
There are parallels, sure.
Novichok, the most powerful nerve agent ever developed by man, even more powerful than VX, and we don't make it anymore. They kill it. The worst way to die. I mean, it's up there. Your convulsions, your vomiting, you lose control, that kind of thing. They were lucky to survive. But in the wake of that, when I would speak to U.S. intelligence officials or European intelligence officials, diplomats, they would say, man, this one scared the bejesus out of us. This one was really, a sign that they're raising their game and they, no holds barred, etc. And I said, yeah, that's rough, but wait a second. 12 years ago, 2006, London, Russia used a very powerful radioactive agent, polonium-210, to murder another Russian dissident successfully, who by then had British citizenship, in very similar form. So why didn't we see the signal then? 12 years before, and we had a similar halting reaction, sign blame over time, release some statements, slap some sanctions on, and yet Russia continues.
And we'll get to this later as we chat, Jim, but of course it raises the issue of what would we do? How far should we go in response to something like that? Because then, in a sense, someone else is dictating the terms of our own actions.
True. And the risks of escalation, no question.
Yeah. Sure. You write about some really extraordinary experiences that you've had in this book, and perhaps some of the more compelling parts are the ones where you are an actor in it, that you're participating in some of the shadow war activities. Let's go back to where you are up close and personal with May 2015. You're on a P-8A Poseidon surveillance aircraft on a mission challenging what China considers to be its sovereign territory. Yeah. What did you see? What did you hear?
We were the first journalists allowed on an operational mission of the P-8A. It's America's most advanced surveillance aircraft. It also happens to be a sub-hunter. And this was a mission with intent. U.S. had been flying these surveillance missions over these islands in the South China Sea, but this is the first time they allowed any journalist, certainly a CNN crew with a television camera. The U.S. wanted to advertise what was happening there on the sea. And China, in the span of a few months, had added thousands of football fields of land to what had been atolls, piles of rocks.
Outcroppings, really.
Peaked above the water at low tide, that kind of thing, to manufacture territory in the midst of seas that are claimed by half a dozen claimants, including U.S. treaty ally the Philippines, but also other friends, Vietnam, etc. And China just did it, you know, in the face of complaints. We were watching them from that plane. You could see the dredgers at work doing this kind of beautiful sort of engineering feat of so they're digging up. They're simultaneously dredging the harbor in the islands while creating land, an airstrip long enough to support any aircraft in the Chinese fleet. Later, they would put in missile installations, hardened bunkers, hardened hangars, etc., on sinkable aircraft carriers. Of course, they warned us away. It got increasingly heated. This is the Chinese Navy. Go away. This is our airspace. And the Americans would kind of read from the script saying, we consider this international airspace. Great. It's a nice demonstration. And we continue, our country does, to carry out these missions both on the surface and in the air. And yet there China is with all these islands. Sure. And no one's touching them.
How have those scripts changed, both the Chinese scripts and the American scripts of these? This is our territory. Go away. No, we are in international airspace. How has that script changed between when you first went on that flight and more recently?
Has not changed.
Yeah.
They're still at it, right? Mm-hmm. And yet the facts are, I mean, we used to talk about facts on the ground, right, in the occupied territories of the Middle East, whatever. The facts on the sea here, the facts on the sea remain.
Facts on newly formed ground.
Exactly.
As it were. Let's talk about a second personal experience. March of last year, how did you end up on a Los Angeles class nuclear attack submarine, the USS Hartford, underneath the Arctic ice?
On my birthday. And you know what?
Happy birthday, Jim.
Thank you very much. The little boy in me was having a ball. As I was writing this book, I wanted to get at the submarine competition. And I'd been following that for some time because in many ways, the days of the carrier are over. Don't tell that to the captain of a carrier or the commander of a carrier group, in part because Russia, particularly China, have developed weapons that it's a big target, right? And missile technology is advanced. A sub is more, just easier to hide, right? And not only that, but also Russia and China have chosen to focus a lot of their resources on developing a capable submarine fleet. So the U.S. trains to track enemy or adversary submarines under the Arctic every couple of years. They're called the ICE-X exercises. And they fell off the map for a bit because it just didn't seem like that was too big a challenge.
Priority.
Not a top priority. The British used to participate. They stopped participating. Recently, of course, Russia introduced two new, more advanced attack and ballistic missile submarines. But also, with the ice melting in the Arctic, it's another great game. It's another front in this great game. Access there, control of the resources, natural resources presumed to be under the surface there, have both the U.S. and Russia throwing a lot of military resources to establish dominance there. So I reached out to the Navy and said, hey, how would you like taking me on your next ICEX exercises? And thankfully, they said yes. And we flew up there out of Dead Horse, Alaska, best named town in America, I think, land on the Arctic ice on a plane with skis attached to it. The USS Hartford pops up through the ice. Its conning tower pops up through the ice, picks us up, and we went down for 3 days chasing. One of the subs would play the Russian sub, the Rabbit sub, and the others would chase him, exercises. And it's serious. I don't want to say they're on a war footing, but they're preparing for the possibility of war. And the kid and me had a ball.
Right. I don't want to give away everything in your book, but I will tell everyone that you really need to read Jim's description of a submarine coming back up through the ice and the calculations that are made for how to do it properly. It's quite a read.
It's not easy. I mean, just one detail I will share is that we think of ice as just kind of flat and, no features, right? Well, on the top, first of all, it's beautiful. It's sort of a kaleidoscope of moving pieces of ice, and it is moving all the time, right? Even when it looks stationary. On the bottom side, it has these huge stalactites of ice going down hundreds of feet in some cases, which creates, a really dangerous operating environment for submarines and also difficult to track because those things are good to hide behind. So it adds to this to the challenge. And as you're breaking through it and you're kind of navigating this otherworldly, almost Lord of the Rings-like kind of atmosphere, it's a ball.
It's a beautiful video game for our children to play. But
yes.
When you're in that sub under the Arctic, it feels a little bit different.
It did feel a little different. They baked me a birthday cake, so, everything was okay.
Back to China for a moment. Most of our listeners know you from CNN and from your work in journalism before then, but you took some time off from that. Back to China, you served as a chief of staff, really a special advisor to the ambassador back in, what, 2012?
2011 to 2013, exactly.
How and why did that come about?
So I've always been interested in China. I studied it in college. I'll tell you an origin story of that. My first 5 years as a foreign correspondent, I was based out in Asia, traveling around China. This was the early 90s in the region. So I always had a China bug in me. And in 2011, I just returned from 10 years in London for ABC, covering the Middle East principally, and of course the wars in the Middle East, with which we are very familiar. And I found myself at the White House Correspondents' Dinner sitting next to the future ambassador to China, Gary Locke. And we just got to talk. We talked for 2 hours about China, and that led to a lunch and a dinner with our wives. And you know, without me looking for it, he said, listen, I can only take one person with me. Would you ever consider going? And I, you know, the first challenge was going to my wife.
Turn to your wife.
Yeah. And she was game. And then just for me, it was a learning opportunity to be on the inside, as it were, and the inside of this relationship at a crucial time. I just thought I had nothing to lose by going there and seeing this relationship from a perspective that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
And how did the management back in the home office feel about you saying, oh, I'm going off to Beijing for a while and not for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I did ask a lot of folks in news before I went what they thought about it. And by and large, most said, man, hard to say no to that.
It's an enriching experience.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter what you end up doing with
it. And it has proven to be. You know, I learned, it's nice having a security clearance. I learned a lot. It was nice to be in the room for a lot of these high-stakes meetings, very difficult ones. I think it's helped me cover the government better because you see how they do what they do.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or how they don't do what
or
they
how
don't
they
do.
They don't do what they don't do.
Right. Yeah. One of the experiences of working inside government is realizing it is a huge bureaucracy.
It is.
And the myths of the deep state cabal that a few people are planning it and go.
Yeah.
Once you see how the inside of an embassy works, or no matter how well managed, you see there's a whole lot of ways that things go wrong every day on small stuff.
Absolutely.
Big stuff wouldn't hold together quite so
well. I would
say
that, you know, I think people have this sort of sense of invincibility of government or all-knowingness, right? You realize at the end of the day, it's imperfect people working with imperfect information, making imperfect decisions.
Sometimes doing some remarkable things with that.
Absolutely.
And sometimes doing some
sometimes
shake your head,
up.
Bang your head against the wall things with
exactly.
that. So in China.
But with good intention, I should say. You know, I think that, you know, particularly in this environment where you have this kind of government versus media, and that's not, I mean, it's the conditions and the degree of it are new today, but that rivalry, whatever you want to call it, has been around for some time. I think that you move back and forth, you realize there aren't evil people on either side. There are Americans who are trying to do the best for their country.
Sure.
Yeah.
Not long after you left Beijing, the State Department spokesman said this. The world is watching to see if China is really the global power it professes itself to be and the responsible power that it professes itself to be. Now, what happens when China says essentially noted and then does what it wants to do anyway? Because one might argue, despite the general impression in your book that Russia and China are similar regarding the shadow war, that the South China Sea, let's say, matters much more strategically to China than even Crimea does to Russia. Mm. Not symbolically, but strategically in terms of sea lanes and things like that. Okay, so perhaps the State Department puts China on warning, saying, you say you want to be a member of the global community. Let's see you prove it. They said, okay, we're still building those islands. How do you respond to that without a massive escalation?
Years. Yeah. You know, and this is the thing, you know, I say to people, this is not a political book because there's a lot of blame to go around and it doesn't distinguish between party because administrations of both parties have missed and misunderstood the threat. And don't base that entirely on me. I speak to very senior officials who serve both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations, and they're self-critical in their analysis. The Jim Clappers, the Michael Haydens, the Ash Carters, John Scarlett, former head of MI6, and others, they will say, listen, we weren't quick enough on this. We didn't know the enemy. We persisted in, and Jim Clapper used this word a lot, mirroring, imagining that Russia and China want what we want, even in the face of obviously contradictory behavior and information. And yet, still couldn't quite shake that idea that, well, if we welcome them in, they will liberalize, they will democratize, they will become a stakeholder, remember that word, in the international rules-based order. Fact is, they see very little advantage in joining that team and lots of advantage in disrupting that world order.
Yeah, so the point that comes out from that in various episodes in the book, but especially at the end where you talk about lessons, is we need to take this more seriously, that we can't just say, well, they want to be a responsible member of the international community, whether Russia or China. Perhaps the last time that this actually worked, and I'd be interested for your views on this, it might have been back with the Bush 41 administration, with the idea of we're not going to rub the Russians' nose in the fact that they lost the Cold War. Yeah. We're going to treat them like an equal. We're not going to rush to expand NATO. We're going to give them a chance to join the international community. But what comes out from your book pretty clearly is certainly during the Clinton administration and then during the Bush 43 administration and certainly in the Obama and the Trump administrations, this can't go on indefinitely because they're not playing along. Where did that go wrong? Was it in the early 1990s, the mid-1990s? Where was that shift when we had given enough time, in this case to the Russians, to say, do you want to be part of this international order? Where was the tipping point?
Well, it's hard to find one moment in there. But what seems clear is that I suppose the fulsomeness of that expectation at each of these moments, right? The fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, but also China's economic liberalization, that each of these moments marked a fundamental change in the way Russian and Chinese leaders see the world and see a world under U.S. leadership. Now, that's not to say that there weren't Russians and Chinese who would have been more amenable or would have pushed for a more cooperative relationship. And Russia during the 90s did have a
And that was the big argument with Yeltsin, too, is try to enable him to do the right thing.
Yes, exactly. And you know, I don't mean to be so fatalistic on that because there are courses that could have led to different leadership in Russia, not a former KGB agent, right?
There's that.
You know? Or China, especially as we're sitting here at the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen, you know, could China have taken a different course then? I've spent a lot of time in China, so I didn't ever imagine that 100 students in Tiananmen Square would suddenly take over the country, but could it have taken a less repressive course? Yes. So, you know, you can't blame everybody because hopefulness at that point, giving them a chance to come in to have a cooperative, friendly relationship, not a bad thing. The trouble was that over the course of years and decades, when they were proving that's not the direction they were going, we persisted in this delusion that they would eventually or over time. And it's also consistent that each president who comes in thinks, I'm going to get this right. George W. Bush looks in Putin's eye. I see someone I could work with. Barack Obama, reset button.
Let's reset it.
And Donald Trump, you could argue with Russia, is still in that space, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's fair to say that 1995 or 1997, maybe it's not right to say that was the tipping point. Mm-hmm. But certainly by 2019, there was a tipping point.
Yeah,
and absolutely. A lot of what has happened that you describe in your book is because of that inability in those 20 years to adjust.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about it, too, is that both Russia and China are conscious of 1991 as a year because Russia, as you know, we may look at that as a happy moment, you know, the fall of the wall, the fall of the Soviet Union, and Gorbachev as a hero. They look at him as a villain, and this as, you know, the moment where Russia lost its mojo, you know. China looks at that same period of time in Russia and its leaders study the fall of the Soviet Union to say, that ain't going to be us, right? We're not going to let that happen. They study it because both of them fear. I mean, these are two power-hungry kind of, if you want to call them parties or cabals at the top, and they don't want to lose that power.
Absolutely. Let's move to space. Mm. You talk in the book about laser capabilities. You talk about KKVs, the kinetic kill vehicles.
Yep.
You even talk about satellites capable of inappropriately touching other satellites, you know, grabbing other satellites by their transponders
and hauling them in. Yes.
What should the U.S. be most worried about in the space domain?
Well, they're already there, right? These weapons are already up there at every level of the space domain. Russia and China have both capably tested kamikaze satellites, kind of the nickname for the kill vehicles, and kidnapper satellites, another kind of nickname for the ones with the grappling arm that the Chinese seem to have perfected. But they've perfected that all the way up to geosynchronous orbit, so 20,000 miles up.
That's remarkable.
Right? And that requires enormous capability, maneuverability, vision, you know.
And the commitment to see it through.
Absolutely. Now, our most sensitive satellites are up there too. Nuclear early warning, for instance. So they can already today cripple the U.S. military. They can. And you know, GPS you know, is so many of our weapons are, you know, it's the disadvantage of being so advanced, right? And therefore, you're more dependent and classic asymmetric warfare. They know that. Mm-hmm. So they know if I kick them up there and I don't have to take out all 24 GPS constellation satellites. Mm-hmm. I can take out a quarter of those and then significantly blind U.S. forces in the field. And then there's the civilian aspect of that, too, is that we have, you know, civilian capabilities that are dependent on those satellite assets. Timestamps, for instance, for U.S. financial markets come from GPS satellites. So you could disable civilian systems as well and significantly paralyze the U.S. in the event of war.
You note in the book that the then head of U.S. Space Command said, a disturbing quote to me at least, he said to you, there will be conflict when it comes to space. I just hope that if conflict happens, it doesn't happen in a way that destroys the space environment.
Yeah.
That's a disturbing statement.
It is. Because there is a mutual assured destruction in space, right? And we've seen this already. China blew up a satellite in space in 2007, created 5,000 pieces of debris moving at 17,500 miles an hour. I mean, you know, a highlighter moving at that speed can destroy a satellite. So when you have big chunks, if you go to war up there, you make realms of space unusable for decades.
Right. Yeah. One remedy, or at least partial remedy, you talk about is purely redundancy, that if we are relying on whether it's 2 or 24 satellites, if you put up an interesting concept, microsatellites, and you put up hundreds of them, the chances of all of them going out are low.
Right. That's the word. The buzzword is resiliency. They talk about is that because you can't. I mean, there are serious discussions about defenses in space. New satellites going into orbit have more maneuverability to get out of the way of a kidnapper satellite. There's talk of shielding because, yes, there are lasers in space, shielding your satellites so they can't be fried by directed energy weapons. I talked to Bob Work, the former deputy defense secretary. He talks about the equivalent of sort of carrier escorts, you know, destroyers. So other satellites that have some defensive capability, maybe even some charges they could send out to send away the other satellite. They talk about all these kinds of things, but you can't defend every satellite to that degree. So you need to be able to survive a limited strike.
Mm-hmm. It is shocking to see some of the parallels here. The swarm attacks, let's say, on a carrier with small boats or with drones, and then a swarm attack in space, even with a good defense, if anything gets through, like you said, the size of a highlighter. Mm-hmm. The satellite is toast.
Yep.
Either way. You put near the end of the book, not at the start of the book, your discussion of election interference and what Russia did in 2016. Why?
Because it started before then, right? And that you have to see the election interference as part of a continuum. It is part of a growing aggressiveness by Russia, but part of a continuum. The point is we should not have been surprised by 2016. 2007, they already carried out a nation-on-nation cyber attack that cut off Estonia, one of the most technologically advanced. Have you ever been there? Those guys,
it's wired.
They vote electronically. Yeah. They do everything electronically. Mm-hmm. Russia shut them down in 2007. And then you have other steps. I mean, the invasion of Georgia with 2008. Should we have really been that surprised by Ukraine? Mm-hmm. You know, and then you move up to this period of time in 2013, 2014, when things really escalated. Part of this, a response to Russia's perception of the Maidan, these pro-Western, anti-Russian democracy protests, you can call them, in Ukraine, they perceive those as kind of, as they often do, as a CIA plot, you know, this kind of thing. And it led to I have a segment in the book where you see the very quick succession of steps in response to that. Crimea, you know, Eastern Ukraine, sadly, soon after that, the MH17 shoot down. Also at the same time, Russia begins a massive cyber attack on the U.S. State Department email system, a successful one. And they were in there for a long time before they were discovered. I speak to Rick Legette, the former deputy director of the NSA, and he says, looking back, we should have seen the State Department email hack as a sign of what was to come in 2016 because they used similar guy, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. They were active a couple of years before. So the reason I do that is to see that there was a buildup. This did not come out of nowhere. You know, that Pearl Harbor, as it were, was preceded by a lot of very aggressive activity.
You mentioned Estonia in that regard as a missed warning sign, if you will, for what happened in the United States. But there's another lesson from Estonia that you draw out, which is their experience taught them to do things differently. And as a society, they're doing things differently that prepare them better for their own front in the shadow war. What are the Estonians getting right?
They're so tough, man. You got to love the Estonians. I mean, this country of 3 million people sitting right on Russia's border. It's had its independence taken away by Russians more than once. And yet they stand in defiance and they take steps that work. First of all, they got a lot of smart people there. They have stood up because they, like the U.S., cannot really compete with the private sector for the smartest tech heads, right? So they've stood up kind of a cyber militia. They compare it to the Minutemen here at Revolutionary War so that you could bring all those smart guys and women, men and women, into action when there's a cyber attack, kind of a national reserve for tech heads. The cyber defense unit, they call it. But they also depend on their population to do their part. They talk repeatedly of cyber hygiene. I interviewed the president of Estonia, who's very remarkable. They teach folks, one, how to spot fake news. Don't be fooled by this crap, right? But also how not to make dumb errors that allow the bad actors into your systems. Because, you know, if you look at the 2016 election interference, right, a lot of Russia's
tools, and other
blunt means. Tools. Right, right. Spear phishing is, you and I can. Yeah. Do a spear phishing attack, right? We could do it. But I tell the story of John Podesta. That's how his emails were exposed. The famous reset your password from Gmail email, which his assistant rightfully sent to their IT person. The IT person said, no, this is illegitimate. But emails back with the miracles of autocorrect, it's legitimate. They click on it. They're in there. Thousands of emails are exposed.
Even when everything goes right, it can still go wrong.
And it was one little – I mean, you could have – I don't know. You could have all the cyber tools you could imagine, but if you make mistakes like that, and Estonia is great about saying, we're all in this. You know, it is a national defense movement, and even simple steps make a difference.
From your time there and your discussions there, is it safe to say that the average 8 or 9 year old in Estonia has better computer security practices than the average adult American?
Or government employee here, right? I mean, look at the OPM hack, right? I mean, these are things where it was easy to get in the door, and the answer is yes, sadly. And where, you know, the other thing I talk about in the book is where is the national leadership on this? Who is calling, I don't want to say calling to arms, but who's calling Americans to their collective defense here? You don't even have, sadly, that senior leadership identifying Russia as a primary threat.
Right. Well, we've talked a lot about problems. Let's move to some of the solutions that you suggest
here. If we have
here.
To, yeah.
One of them is know your enemy. We've already talked about that a bit. Do you think we are in a better place now than we were a year or two ago because of what happened in 2016? Have some eyes been opened about the threat primarily from Russia, but also the overall threat from outside of the nation's borders?
For some, but not for others. I mean, the president won't identify that as a crucial threat. And we've all heard these accounts from inside the White House. He associates it with his victory and doesn't want to go there, right? Now, that doesn't mean nothing's happening. And to his credit, this administration has enabled offensive cyber activities that the Obama administration did not. So that, you know, meeting them, as they'll often talk about, out on the battlefield. Don't wait till they come in, you know, sort of come in the front door here or attempt to come in the front door. So it's mixed, right? But in terms of leadership at the top, a clear direction. This is an adversary. They're trying to do X to us. The intelligence shows it. You don't hear that from the top. Now, I spend most of my time in the book talking to the folks on the front lines, the folks in the NSA Operations Center, the submarine commanders under the Arctic, diplomats in Eastern Europe.
And they get it.
They get it. The folks in Space Command, they get it. And they're taking steps and they're working hard. And you hear it from the intel chiefs. You hear it from the commander of Cyber Command. So folks recognize it and they are taking steps. But they also agree you can't win it unless you have a whole of government response, which requires leadership from the top, and they don't hear it.
Right. And also avoiding one of the other things you identify, which is the mirror imaging.
Yes.
The problem of expecting them to do what we would do in a similar circumstance.
Yep.
That sounds good, but it's kind of hard to get yourself in the mind of somebody who thinks assassinating a political opponent on the soil of the United Kingdom is a good idea.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jim Clapper has a good line in here that we're not good at threats that we haven't seen yet, right? And he gives the 9/11 example. He said, what if George Tenet had come out in August of 2001 and said, listen, we're getting a lot of chatter about attacks targeting aviation. All Americans, you now have to go through, you got to take your shoes off. You got to go through the detector. No liquids on air, that kind of thing. On airlines, folks would have said, what?
He would have been laughed out of town.
Yeah. Now, the trouble is, you can argue, we've had that cyber Pearl Harbor, if you want to call it, because we had this gross and quite effective interference in one of our most sacred institutions, the 2016 election, but it's been so politicized that you have one side or a significant portion of one side that won't acknowledge the seriousness of
that threat.
Is that
a surprise to you? Because you've talked with plenty of people on air and not on air. You've talked with plenty of people who get it from both sides of the aisle and common sense legislation moving forward on even the narrow topic of election security. Mm-hmm. People seem to get it. They just can't push it through the entire system, including the president's signature.
Or over the president's objection, right? Or clear lack of interest. You know, you read the story about Kirstjen Nielsen saying Mick Mulvaney instructed folks not to bring up election security with the president.
Right.
That's remarkable.
Hard to get action at that point.
Yeah.
Another solution you recommend, setting red lines.
Mm.
Let me put this to you. Would the United States people of the United States, would the Congress of the United States support going into a shooting war with China over them extending a runway on Mischief Reef?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. Clearly no, right? They put the runway there and no. I mean, we sail the ships by there. We do the fun ops, right? Mm-hmm. The freedom of navigation operations. We fly the planes over. I know because I flew on one, right? But clearly in that case, China calculated correctly that we were not willing to go to war over it. What's interesting, because folks often ask me, okay, what are the next potential flashpoints?
Sure.
Taiwan. There's a lot of concern in the five-sided building across the river here that China might get aggressive on Taiwan and make a grab. Would the U.S. go to war over that? Would we? I mean, we've been sailing a lot of ships through the strait and submarines and advertising it. That's with purpose. There's an arms deal being considered now for Taiwan. But would the U.S. truly go to war and honor that commitment? I don't know. On the other side of the globe, would the U.S. truly go to war in Estonia despite Article 5 of NATO?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tucker Carlson did a show about this a couple months ago. Should we send American men and women to die there?
Right.
It's an open question.
Ukraine is more understandable. And you talk about in the book the discussion over Ukraine and the fact it was not in NATO.
Right.
So some activity there, while outside the pale in many ways, it's understandable that Russia could see, oh, we can get away with this. Estonia, they have to think a little bit harder, even with a president who has somewhat discounted the obligations under Article 5.
But the brilliance of hybrid warfare, right, and shadow war tactics is that Russia would be unlikely to roll, you know, a tank division across the border into Estonia. Mm-hmm. They might do what they did in Crimea. How about some little green men? How about some pro-Russian separatists there, Russian nationals who are clamoring for protection from Estonian government who is taking the right? You know, this is the narrative that they created that narrative in Georgia.
Yep. The playbook is there.
It's there. Yeah.
One of the solutions that evolves from that of setting red lines is raising costs, is making it appear as if the red line really is a red line and not just a pale pink one. There is something out there, at least with China. A couple of years ago, there was a proposed South China Sea and East China Sea. I can't remember, but one of the sanctions acts that was proposed, and that's being talked about again. Is that enough? Do you think that's something like an act of Congress, even if you get the president to sign it, but saying we'll have even harder sanctions if you keep building? Is that going to matter to China after what's happened in the last couple of years?
Doubt it. I mean, we've tried the sanctions thing on a lot of stuff. I mean, we have a lot of sanctions based on the Crimea invasion and annexation, based on the occupation of eastern Ukraine, based on the shootdown of MH17. I tell a long story in there about, you know, the Russian weapon that took that down from Russian-controlled territory and how that was established. Yet Russians are still in eastern Ukraine. They're still in Crimea. China's still in the South China Sea. Clearly, that policy hasn't worked.
It's a real
dilemma. It's imposed costs, but it hasn't changed the behavior.
It's a real dilemma to have costs, credible costs that are high enough to make them think twice, at least think twice.
Well, they talk. I mean, in the solutions chapter, folks like Ash Carter and others suggest some higher level sanctions that might conceivably make a difference, or at least would be hard. I mean, of course, there are sector sanctions. You can go after the oil sector. That would have a big economic effect. They talk about what about cyber attacks or information operations where you expose Vladimir Putin's wealth, you know, go after the man. Ash Carter brings up the example of showing to the Russian people how many Russian soldiers are dying in Syria, because Russia denies that they deploy them. We know they're there. You know, you could do attacks with sort of cause.
So not any longer the one size fits all government to government sanctions, but targeting them either in terms of personalities or what might be called covert influence operations.
Absolutely.
To say, we are going to show you what your own government is doing to raise the costs to that government.
That's one category.
Yeah. Another solution you propose is new treaties, that is trying to come to a new understanding, as we have on other controversial topics over the course of modern history internationally. In your case, talking specifically about cyber and space. The law of the sea, not ratified in the United States, but you suggest it's at least a start. What would we need to see, either in cyber or in space? What would we need to see in a treaty that would make headway on this enough to make the Russians and the Chinese take notice?
That's the question. You know, there is no treaty for space. There's no treaty for cyberspace. We have, as a country, negotiated with enemies before, right? I mean, in the midst of the Cold War, you had nuclear treaties. You had red phones. I mean, you know, to help reduce the risk of mutually assured destruction, you have mutually assured destruction in cyberspace and in space. We don't think about it in the same terms. I mean, you can, as John Hyten, now former head of Space Command, now the head of Strategic Command, he makes the point in the book that you can make space unusable if you blow up enough satellites for decades. All that stuff floating around is shrapnel moving at 17,500 miles an hour. It's fast. It could destroy stuff. So you have mad circumstances in space, which should compel, because everybody pays the price for that, sides to say, okay, let's say you cannot – I mean, you could list a whole host of things. You can't put kamikaze satellites in space, you know. Now, the trouble is these are all dual use. Russia and China call them maintenance satellites, right? You know, they're up there to, turn a screw on
another satellite.
Exactly, and fix it. Yeah. And then same in cyberspace. I mean, what you could set limits that, you know, treat turning the power off in Washington, D.C. as an act of war. And actually, the U.S. has begun to change – its rules of escalation, for instance, that – and I can't quote the exact language, but I know the spirit of it, that the U.S. now treats a cyber attack that is devastating on U.S. soil as the rough equivalent of a nuclear attack, in which case you could use a nuclear response to some cyber attacks. You know, it's language like that. And try to get these guys around the table to talk about it. It's difficult, but you have to find a way.
Another solution you point to is, honestly, leadership, is better leadership. And you say the shadow war may be won or lost on the basis of a sense of shared mission. You speak widely with policymakers and opinion leaders across NATO and like-minded countries on Russia and on China. Is anyone getting there? Are we close to a shared sense of mission regarding the shadow war?
We can't even do it in our own country, right? I mean, look at the way our leaders are shouting at each other over what should be a gimme on – I mean, Russia does not have our interests at heart in any of these – in any of these spheres of influence. So, and by the way, we just saw a Russian destroyer nearly ram a U.S. cruiser, right? You know, interestingly, in the East China Sea, this is an example of where Russia and China saw, I would say, they're not working together, but they do see areas where they could, you know, they have shared interests.
So you wouldn't call it criminal collusion, Jim.
Exactly.
You would just say shared interests.
Conspiracy.
Yes.
Shared interests when opportunistically. Yeah.
Right. Finally, a solution that you talk about that is probably your most controversial is going on the offense, especially when it regards issues like cyber and space, because frankly, the United States on cyber is more vulnerable than most of its adversaries. So you decide, let's say in 2016, you talk a little bit in the book about the dispute within the Obama administration about how to react to the evidence of Russian electoral interference, with President Obama arguing, we've got some issues here. We're very vulnerable. We got some political issues getting around this, and people like John Kerry saying, but we need to go back and go back hard.
Yep.
How do you play that out? Because the harder you play offense, in a sense, the more you risk your own vulnerabilities being exploited.
There's a risk of a cyber arms race and a space arms race, right? I mean, and that was the Obama administration was very attuned to and concerned about escalation in that sense. And that's always the risk here. I don't have the magic sort of balance in there because there are real risks, but it is a question that U.S. leaders and strategists have to confront is, would the deployment of some weapons in space be a deterrent, you know, based on – because U.S. has enormously advanced capabilities. Would they be a deterrent or a spark to greater arms race? Could that precede sitting down at a table and having a treaty? You know, I'm not, to be clear, advocating for offensive weapons, but I'm saying that decision has to be debated as part of the strategy. And clearly, in the cyberspace, this administration has already made the decision that a more forward-leaning offensive posture in cyberspace is necessary.
And it goes back to that same dilemma we talked about before, which is how far do you go to put up a red line and to make it a credible cost when the cost to you of any retaliation is much, much greater. Would the American people support, let's say, threats of severe action against the Russians for continuing to meddle in Ukraine if the Russian response is taking down the U.S. economy by destroying us through cyber?
Well, that's the risk,
It's a hard sell.
It is. Although when you're getting your butt kicked on so many of these fronts, you have to figure out a way to ratchet up the pressure. Of course, as always, the devil's in the details of how far you push.
What has the reaction been from current officials? Because you talk a lot with former officials, many of whom, you mentioned Ash Carter, you mentioned Jim Clapper and others, many of whom dealt with these issues, either as policymakers or as advisors.
They were in charge as it was happening.
They were trying to make these decisions. And in retrospect, they think, I didn't get it quite right. Are current officials learning from that, or do you think they're too consumed by the inbox?
I did try to go through the front door of the Trump administration on this, and I do speak to some current – I mean, you know, John Hyten, current head of Strategic Command, and other folks at the sort of the frontline level in Space Command and elsewhere. It's a sensitive issue for the Trump administration on this, and that sensitivity, that political sensitivity is part of the issue here, right? Because it's a sensitive issue for the president. But you hear – when you hear the public statements of Dan Coats, for instance, the current DNI, or sitting Republican members of Congress, they don't mince words about the severity of the threat and the attention that needs to be put on this and the alertness, et cetera. So they're speaking in those terms and they are taking some steps. But again, not at the very top.
Yeah. As disturbing and as alarming as this book is, it is in a sense the tip of the iceberg, because some of the very things you talk about Russia and China doing at level 10, we're seeing other countries like Iran or North Korea do at level 5 or more. Do you have a second shadow war book in the works? Are you going to be trying to look at those issues as, in a sense, other countries are learning from Russia and China how to exploit the West's weaknesses?
I'm going to take a little break before I write that book, but that's a good idea. I will. And it is clear, to be clear, North Korea and Iran use shadow war tactics. Mm-hmm. They've got directed energy weapons. They both have something of a nuclear program. They both have cyber capabilities. So they also use them. And you know, at a smaller scale, but we have other adversaries in the same war.
Yeah, you paint a bleak picture, Jim, but you also have some food for thought on the solutions. Thanks for chatting with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jim Sciutto for coming on the show. Please do share the podcast, tell your friends about it, anything you can do to help us spread the word. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Matt Kahn and Michaela Fogel stepped up as audio engineers, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.